Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Heute mit Katja Weber. Herzlich willkommen, schön, dass ihr dabei seid im Hörsaal. Politiker und Forscherinnen, Aktivistinnen und Unterhändler weltweit packen gerade ihre 7 Sachen und machen sich auf den Weg nach Paris. Dort in Le Bourget, nordöstlich der französischen Hauptstadt gelegen, findet ab Montag die gigantisch große UN-Klimakonferenz statt. Der ehemalige Grünen-Politiker Hermann Ott vom Wuppertal-Institut für Klima, Umwelt und Energie hat sich jahrelang mit Umweltrecht und den entsprechenden Abkommen befasst. Und er findet im Interview mit den Kollegen von Deutschlandradio Kultur ein drastisches Bild für die Entsandten der fast 200 Nationen, die in Le Bourget verhandeln werden.
Wenn man sich überlegt, eine Gruppe von Junkies wollte nun aussteigen, gemeinsam aus der Droge, aber jeder und auch die, die als Dealer arbeiten und also das Zeug verkaufen, können jederzeit Widerspruch einlegen gegen jedwede Maßnahme. Dann kann man sich vorstellen, wie weit so eine Gruppe kommen würde.
Dealer und Junkies der Kohlendioxidemissionen sollen sich über ein drogenfreies Leben verständigen. Na prima. Dennoch, Ott ist optimistisch, dass diese Konferenz eine Einigung bringen wird. Aber er ist ausgesprochen pessimistisch, dass diese Einigung irgendetwas taugen wird.
Es bewegt sich alles auf eine Vereinbarung zu. Es wird eine Vereinbarung geben. Man wird nicht nochmal wie in Kopenhagen nach Hause fahren ohne ein Ergebnis. Aber das wird der kleinste gemeinsame Nenner sein, der in keinster Weise ausreicht, um den Klimawandel effektiv zu bekämpfen.
Denn die Verhandlungen auf UN-Ebene müssen im Konsens geführt werden. Alle Nationen müssen dem Verhandlungsergebnis zustimmen können, sagt Ott.
Das ist natürlich ein Rezept für Lähmung.
Kleinster gemeinsamer Nenner in der Klimapolitik? Politik der ruhigen Hand, Politik der kleinen Schritte? Bullshit, sagt auch die kanadische Journalistin Naomi Klein. Jetzt muss es schnell gehen, denn die Erwärmung des Weltklimas um mehr als 2 Grad wird dramatische Folgen haben.
Climate change changes everything. We're talking about 4 to 6 degrees of warming Celsius. That changes everything about our physical world. So that's bad timing. Privatization, deregulation, free trade deals, low taxes. We have waited so long and done so many of precisely the wrong thing that we now find ourselves with no non-radical options left on the table. It is really about a conflict between capitalism and the climate. Now, if you're a fan of capitalism, that's a really inconvenient truth.
Vielleicht bereiten sich ja manche von euch gerade für den Climate March morgen in Berlin vor, der für öffentlichen Druck vor den Verhandlungen sorgen soll. Zumal ja die Demo in Paris nach den Anschlägen vom 13. November abgesagt werden musste. Wenn's nach Naomi Klein geht, demonstrieren die Aktivisten morgen nicht nur für eine konsequente Begrenzung der Erderwärmung, sondern Think Big gegen das kapitalistische System. Trippelschritte haben die Industrienationen viel zu lange gemacht, sagt Klein. Jetzt müssen die 7 Meilenstiefel her. Insofern gehört sie vielleicht auch zu der Avantgarde, die es nach Ansicht des Umweltrechtlers Hermann Ott nun braucht, um verkrustete Diskussionsabläufe aufzubrechen.
Tatsächlich ist es aber doch so, dass die Fortschritte in der Welt immer nur durch eine kleinere Gruppe kommen. Ob das Menschen sind, ob das Städte sind, ob das Regionen oder ob das Staaten sind. Das heißt, es müssen einfach einige vorangehen und andere mitziehen und ein leuchtendes Beispiel setzen. Wenn man immer nur darauf wartet, dass alle mitziehen, dann kommt man überhaupt nirgendwo hin.
Ich weiß nicht, ob Naomi Klein ein leuchtendes Beispiel ist, aber auf jeden Fall ist sie eine Autorin und eine Rednerin, die viele Menschen bewegt. Am 22. März 2015 kamen jedenfalls mehr als 1000 Menschen ins Berliner Haus der Kulturen der Welt, um ihren Vortrag in der Reihe Democracy Lecture zu hören, veranstaltet von den Blättern für deutsche und internationale Politik. Kleins Kernthese: Unser Wirtschaftssystem und unser Ökosystem befinden sich miteinander im Krieg. Wir haben keine Zeit mehr für lange Verhandlungen. Die Zeit, in der wir gemütlich hätten umsteuern können, die ist abgelaufen. Jetzt bleiben uns nur noch radikale Möglichkeiten. Naomi Klein wird immer wieder als Globalisierungskritikerin vorgestellt, dabei ist das Mumpitz. Sie kritisiert nicht die Globalisierung, sondern den globalen Kapitalismus. No Logo hieß das Buch, mit dem sie um die Jahrtausendwende rum bekannt wurde. In ihrem neuesten Buch Die Entscheidung – Kapitalismus versus Klima verbindet sie jetzt ihre Kritik einer unregulierten Marktwirtschaft mit dem Klimawandel. Wer das Klima schützen will, kann nicht am Kapitalismus festhalten, meint sie. Eine steile These, die sie da entwickelt. Und das wohl, wie sie bei ihrem Vortrag erzählt hat, aus einer ganz kleinen alltäglichen Situation heraus. Aus welcher, das werden wir gleich hören. Naomi Klein liest zu Beginn ihres Vortrages 5 Minuten lang die Einleitung aus ihrem Buch vor, dann kommt ihre Rede, die Entscheidung, Kapital versus Klima. Bevor es losgeht, ganz schnell noch eine kleine Übersetzungshilfe für die Anekdote, die gleich kommt. Ein Moose ist ein Elch.
What gets me most are not the scary scientific studies about melting glaciers, the ones I used to avoid. It's the books I read to my 2-year-old. Looking for a Moose is one of his favorites. It's about a bunch of kids that really, really, really want to see a moose. They search high and low through a forest, a swamp, in brambly bushes and up a mountain for a long-legged, bulgy-nosed, branchy-antlered moose. Have you ever seen a moose, they ask? The joke is that there actually are mooses all over the book, on every page, and the kids can't see them. In the end, the animals all come out of hiding, and the ecstatic kids proclaim, "We've never, ever, ever, ever seen so many moose." Now, on about the 75th reading, it suddenly hit me. He might never see a moose. I tried to hold it together. I went back to my computer and began to write about my time in northern Alberta, tar sands country, where members of the Beaver Lake Cree First Nation told me about how the moose had changed. One woman described killing a moose on a hunting trip, only to find that the flesh had turned green. I heard a lot about strange tumors, too, which locals assumed had to do with animals drinking water contaminated by tar sands toxins. But mostly, I heard about how the moose were simply gone, and not just in Alberta. Rapid climate change turns North Woods into moose graveyard, reads a May 2012 headline in Scientific American. A year and a half later, the New York Times was reporting that one of Minnesota's 2 moose populations had declined from 4,000 in the 1990s to just 100 today. Will he ever see a moose? Then, the other day, I was slain by a miniature board book called Snuggle Wuggle. It involves different animals cuddling, with each posture given a ridiculously silly name. How does a bat hug, it asks. Topsy-turvy, topsy-turvy. For some reason, my son reliably cracks up at this page. I explain that topsy-turvy means upside down, because that's the way bats sleep. But all I can think about is the report of some 100,000 dead and dying bats raining down from the sky in the midst of record-breaking heat in parts of Australia, whole colonies devastated. Will he ever see a bat? I knew I was in trouble the other day when I found myself bargaining with starfish. Red and purple ones are ubiquitous on the rocky coast of British Columbia, where my parents live and where my son was born and where I've spent about half of my adult life. They're always the biggest kid pleasers because you can gently pick one up and give it a really good look. This is the best day of my life, my 7-year-old niece Miriam, visiting from Chicago, proclaimed after a long afternoon spent in the tide pools. But in the fall of 2013, stories began to appear about a strange wasting disease that was causing starfish along the Pacific coast to die by the tens of thousands. Termed the sea star wasting syndrome, multiple species were disintegrating alive, their vibrant bodies melting into distorted globs with legs falling off and bodies caving in. Scientists were mystified. As I read these stories, I caught myself praying that the invertebrates would hang in for just one more year, long enough for my son to be amazed by them. But then I doubted myself. Maybe it's better if he never sees a starfish at all, certainly not like this. When fear like that used to creep through my armor of climate change denial, I would do my utmost to stuff it away, change the channel, click past it. Now I try to feel it. It seems to me that I owe it to my son, just as we all owe it to one another and to ourselves. But what should we do with this fear that comes from living on a planet that is dying, made less alive every day? First, accept that it won't go away, that it is a fully rational response to an unbearable reality. Next, use it. Fear is a survival response. Fear makes us run, it makes us leap, it can make us act superhuman. But we need somewhere to run to. Without that, the fear is only paralyzing. So the real trick, the only hope, really, is to allow the terror of an unlivable future to be balanced and soothed by the prospect of building something much better than many of us had previously dared hope. Yes, there will be things that we will lose, luxuries that some of us will have to give up, whole industries that will disappear. And it's too late to stop climate change from coming. It's already here, and increasingly brutal disasters are headed our way no matter what we do. But it's not too late to avert the worst. And there is still time to change ourselves so that we are far less brutal to one another when those disasters strike. And that, it seems to me, is worth a great deal. Because the thing about a crisis this big, this all-encompassing, is that it changes everything. It changes what we can do, what we can hope for, what we can demand from ourselves and from our leaders. It means there's a whole lot of stuff we've been told is inevitable that simply cannot stand. And it means there's a whole lot of stuff we've been told is impossible that has to start happening right away. Can we pull it off? All I know is that nothing is inevitable. Nothing except that climate change changes everything. And for a very brief time, the nature of that change is still up to us. Thank you. So that concludes the formal reading part of the evening, and things will just start to get more chaotic from here on in. And then Ulrich Brand will restore some order. Yesterday, here in Berlin, a journalist told me that he did not agree with my book because he is a moderate and he does not like radical change. He pointed out that radical change has a bad history in Germany, and so most Germans feel the same way that he does. Slow and steady wins the race. No sudden movements. I told him I understood. Radical change scares most of us, in fact, and a lot of the time, it does turn out really badly. But here is the dilemma in which we find ourselves when we speak about climate change in 2015. We have waited so long and done so many of precisely the wrong thing that we now find ourselves with no non-radical options left on the table. So the reason why in English I called the book This Changes Everything is not because I think this book changes everything, but because climate change does. If we stay on the road we're on, we face radical changes to our physical world. Now, this is not a conspiracy theory. This is what we are hearing from our most staid establishment institutions like the World Bank, like PricewaterhouseCoopers, like the International Energy Agency. What they tell us is that if we continue on the road we're on, it leads us straight to 4 to 6 degrees Celsius of warming above pre-industrial levels. And it's always worth remembering that when our politicians went to Copenhagen in 2009, they defined dangerous climate change as anything above 2 degrees Celsius of warming. And when they defined it in that way, African delegates marched through the halls of the Bella Center in Copenhagen and called it genocide. We're talking about 4 to 6 degrees of warming Celsius. That changes everything about our physical world. It's major cities disappearing, it's whole nations under the waves, it's massive crop failure. It's possibly much worse because the truth is that climate models pretty much break down at around 3 degrees. And the most honest climate scientists will tell you they have no idea what 4 degrees, let alone 6 degrees of warming looks like. This is not apocalypticism, although it sounds like it. It's the overwhelming scientific consensus. And all we have to do is to arrive at that place is nothing. Just keep on keeping on. Now, in climate modeling, this is politely called business as usual, the business as usual scenario, which disguises the fact that there is nothing usual about it. Now, some scientists look at these very frightening outcomes and in desperation propose radical engineering solutions like spraying sulfur into the stratosphere or fertilizing the oceans or seeding the clouds so that they're more reflective. In other words, geoengineering, hacking the planet, these sci-fi so-called solutions to climate change. Pretty radical stuff. These are not our only options. It is not too late to have a pretty good chance of keeping warming below 2 degrees Celsius. We could even decide to keep warming below 1.5 if we wanted to. But to do that, this also requires radical changes, at least by our current standards. They involve making radical changes to our political and economic systems and to the underlying pro-corporate so-called free market ideology that still holds our elites in its thrall. Because that ideology has everything to do with why we have failed and continue to fail to come to terms with this increasingly urgent crisis. So there have been all kinds of theories put forward to explain why we humans have done such a bad job of responding to climate change. Since our governments started to agree on lowering emissions, emissions have gone up by 61%. So whatever it is that we've been doing hasn't worked. And you've all heard the various theories. Often it's blamed on human nature. We're just too selfish, we're too greedy, it's too abstract, it's too far off. The UN is too complex, governments can't agree on anything. But, you know, there's problems with all of these theories, right? Because, of course, our governments have agreed on lots of things in international forums. And in this same period when they failed to come up with binding climate treaties, they built the World Trade Organization, for instance, which, you know, is an incredibly elaborate global deal with binding rules and tough penalties. So they can agree sometimes. Climate change isn't all that abstract anymore. You know, this issue that we started talking about as, you know, a problem for our grandkids is now a problem that is banging down our doors and manifesting itself very overtly through massive storms, through devastating droughts, and I'm not going to go into all of that because you know it. So the theory I put forward in the book is that we have overlooked a really obvious explanation, which is a case of epic bad timing, by which I mean that climate change landed on our laps at the worst possible moment in human evolution that it possibly could have, and that moment was 1988. 1988 was the year that the first intergovernmental meeting was held on climate change, was held in the city where I live, Toronto, that eventually led to the Rio Earth Summit. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was formed in 1988. James Hansen testified on Capitol Hill, the famed climate scientist, saying that he now had a high degree of certainty that greenhouse gas emissions were causing warming. That year, the editors of Time magazine, when they had to choose their man of the year, chose planet Earth. So 1988 was the year. And I feel like in this country, people understand the historical significance really well of what else was happening in that period, right? This is the year before the Berlin Wall collapses. It is the moment Francis Fukuyama declares history over. There is one ideology that will now dominate the world. It is the triumphant moment for the neoliberal project. And the basic pillars of that project are very familiar to us by now. Privatization, deregulation, cuts to corporate taxes, paid for with cuts to public spending, now called austerity, all locked in under corporate free trade deals. So the first part of the book, I explain why this set of policies clashes directly with what we need to do in the face of climate change. And, you know, it's pretty straightforward, right? I mean, climate change is the essence of a collective crisis. It requires collective action within our communities, within our nation states, between our nation states, of an unprecedented scale. And it hits us at a time when we have been told that there is no such thing as society, to quote Margaret Thatcher, and that there is something suspect about collective action and that we are nothing more than gratification-seeking units. So that's bad timing. And many of the spaces, of the collective spaces, where we would have gathered to solve this problem were under siege. Regulation became a dirty word, obviously taxation at the same time. And you know, getting off fossil fuels when they're the foundation of your economy is expensive. It takes money, you have to get it from somewhere. It would have made sense to get it from the polluters, to get it from the people who had the most money, but this was the time when we were slashing those taxes, and any kind of top-down regulation was described, at least in North America, as command and control. So when climate change was acknowledged as a crisis, there were many attempts to try to fit it into, to shoehorn it into this ideological project. And the most obvious way that this manifested itself was through the kind of the mania for what is often called market-based solutions. So rather than taking a regulatory approach towards carbon pollution, putting clear caps, like banning the stuff, you know, telling corporations what they could and could not do, everything had to be win-win. So markets were created, markets in pollution. And this was driven by the US in the UN negotiations. Interestingly, it was fiercely rejected by Angela Merkel, who was the environment minister at the time. I believe her quote was that it would be leaving climate change to the law of the jungle. Europe, in fact, argued forcefully against emission trading as a solution to climate change. But the US carried the day because, of course, everybody wanted the US to sign the Kyoto Protocol. So it was embedded in the agreement. Al Gore and Bill Clinton went home, did not get the US to sign the Kyoto Protocol. In fact, it was a unanimous vote against it in Congress. And Europe became the laboratory for emission trading, and it has been, I think it's fair to say, a complete disaster. This was not the right approach. So you see these clashes with the war on the collective, the war on taxation, regulation, and I think in Germany you have a pretty vivid example of this tension, because although you have been in the midst of a historic energy transition, which I write about, you know, in very laudatory ways in the book, and I think it has much to teach and is very exciting on lots of levels, and I know hotly debated and being changed all the time, while there has been this willingness to break some rules of the free market and put some supports, many supports in place for renewable energy, there has been an unwillingness to break this cardinal neoliberal rule and say no to coal, to actually tell the coal companies that they can't dig up the dirtiest fossil fuel on the planet, that being lignite coal. So that obviously impacts the success of this transition. And we're going to be hearing about that a little bit later on, but I think it's an example of how the triumph of this ideology stands in the way of the obvious things we need to do in the face of the climate crisis, even in the country that is frankly leading the way. Another barrier that I think a lot of people here know a lot about is the logic of privatization, right? So in this period, the 1990s, when our governments are meeting, negotiating the Kyoto Protocol, talking about how what we're going to do with climate change, those same governments are systematically selling off many of the key sectors of the economy that you most would want to control if you were going to take climate change seriously. That being your energy grids, your rail systems, your transit systems, the pieces of your economy that are most intimately tied to fossil fuels. If you sell them off to for-profit companies, they're going to be less enthusiastic about giving up a very, very profitable business model. And I say that this is something that you know a lot about in Germany, because there's been this incredible grassroots movement in cities and towns of people deciding to take back control over their energy grids for precisely this reason. This movement in the U.S., this is called remunicipalization, which is a really ugly word, but this is starting to happen in small cities like Boulder, Colorado, Santa Fe. You know, it's not coming from an ideological place. It's not coming from an ideological opposition to privatization. It's coming from a desire to switch to renewable energy, and then residents finding themselves confronted with for-profit energy companies that simply won't do it. And that is leading to this local power movement, people taking back control of their energy grids. So you have that tension. But we are still giving away key assets, you know, even in the midst of this, that are so central to a transition away from fossil fuels. In fact, One of the key fights playing out right now between Greece and the trilogy formerly known as the Troika is whether or not Greece is going to go ahead with plans to sell its energy companies, despite the fact that Syriza ran on a platform saying that it wouldn't. And also, there are battles going on about whether Greece is going to sell off its rail system. There are fights over rail privatization playing out in Greece, Spain, Portugal, and Italy right now, as well as Belgium. And this is all about austerity. So the biggest conflicts between climate change and market policies are obviously with the logic of austerity, because if you're going to take this crisis seriously, it requires massive investments in the public sphere to protect ourselves from the heavy weather that we've already locked in, and also to build the infrastructure of the post-carbon future. We've seen what it looks like when a neglected public sphere collides with heavy weather. It looks like New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. In the midst of Hurricane Katrina, you had a levee system that, despite repeated warnings, was just allowed to rot and decay. The storm breaks through it, and then the city is abandoned by a government, three levels of government, that all appears to be missing in action. You know, some of you are too young, many of you will remember the shock you felt looking at images of people on their rooftops in New Orleans holding signs that said help, and no one came. Or in the Superdome in New Orleans, where residents were left for 5 days without food and water when the federal government seemed to not be able to find New Orleans on the map. That's what it looks like when a gutted public sphere collides with climate change. It looks like New Orleans. So the stakes of this are very, very high. We've seen many examples of this during the big floods that hit Britain the winter before last. It was a big problem for David Cameron because, you know, Mr. Austerity had slashed the agency, the environment agency that is responsible for flood protection in the UK. They had cut hundreds of flood protection programs and laid off more than 1,000 workers with more than 1,000 more on the chopping block, and suddenly people in the UK were wondering whether that was a very good idea. But then something really ugly happened, which is that the Daily Mail ran a petition off its front page calling on the British government to cut funding from foreign aid and use it to defend the homeland. Why are we spending money on poor people in Bangladesh when we should be protecting ourselves at home? And I think that's the sort of thing that I mean when I say we can change how brutal we are to one another, and why this really is a question of what values are going to govern our society. Because if we stay on the road we're on, it's not just about the temperatures getting hotter. It's about what this system that values individualism so much and pits us against each other within our countries and between our countries, what that will look like in a hotter world. And I think that petition is just the barest glimpse of it. These connections are clear. And, you know, in the name of austerity and budget constraints, support for renewable energy programs have been slashed in recent years in Greece, Spain, Portugal, and Italy, and all of these countries. Before the economic crisis hit, they were in the midst of a green energy boom. It was far from perfect, but it was happening. And it was one of the first things to go, and one of the things that was least noticed, because of course when people are focused on daily concerns, like whether they can feed their families, they're not going to be focused on whether their government has just slashed support for a solar farm and opened up the door for yet another lignite coal-burning power plant owned by a German company. But that is what's been happening in Greece. In addition to cutting support in the name of austerity for renewable energy programs in southern Europe, at the same time, all of the countries I named are in the midst of a major push to drill for oil off their coasts, and many of them to frack for gas. And this is happening in Germany as well. So that's why when I was in Frankfurt the other day, speaking at the protests against the European Central Bank, what I was doing there was I was actually there to propose a friendly merger between the anti-austerity movement and the climate justice movement, because it makes no sense that these are treated as separate issues, that when you have mass protests... (clears throat) When you have mass protests against rail privatization in Brussels, for instance, the words climate change are never even mentioned. So we're failing to make these really obvious connections. And yet the logic of austerity is wholly incompatible with science-based climate action. Indeed, the urgency of the climate crisis, I believe, is the best argument anti-austerity activists and the political parties that support them have ever had for a radically different approach to the economic crisis. So if you connect the dots, you see more connections still. And I have a chapter of the book on how trade, free trade, is trumping the climate again and again and again. And, you know, I come from, you know, what used to be called the anti-globalization movement, although we always rejected the phrase anti-globalization. We were opposing the globalization of a particular model, this corporate liberation project. And what's become clear in recent years is that these free trade deals, and now we're facing a whole new wave of them, very aggressive ones like the TTIP, these deals are actively standing in the way of the types of policies we need our governments to adopt in the face of climate change. I live in Ontario, Canada, and we actually had what was the most ambitious green energy program anywhere in North America. And it was passed, it was adopted during the economic crisis. It was an example, actually, of the kind of win-win strategy that I lay out in the book, where here we were in Ontario facing a jobs crisis because the Ontario economy is really dependent on the big three automakers. That's the core of our manufacturing sector. The auto companies were in crisis. They were going to the U.S. government for bailouts, which meant that if they were going to close any factories, it made sense to close them in Canada. So people were losing their jobs in droves. And the Ontario government came up with a very good plan to set very clear targets to phase out coal completely by 2015, really the kind of aggressive targets that we need to be adopting. They adopted a feed-in tariff program modeled on Germany in part. But they also said that this has to be a jobs program. And in Germany, we know 400,000 jobs have been created in the renewable energy sector. So in Ontario, part of our energy program required that anybody who wanted to take advantage of the benefits of the feed-in tariff program had to produce a certain percentage of their solar panels and wind turbines and other equipment locally in Ontario so that it would help support this ailing manufacturing sector. And it worked. 31,000 jobs were created. And in the book, I tell the story of this factory on the outskirts of Toronto that was an auto parts factory. It's called Silfab. And it was closed in the midst of the economic crisis. And then it was reopened as a plant producing solar panels and rehired many of the workers from the auto sector who'd lost their jobs because it turns out that these skills were entirely compatible. So this is an example of what we call a just transition, the people losing their jobs in one sector, being retrained, getting jobs in the next sector. It was working, it was a success, and then the EU and Japan took Canada to the World Trade Organization and said this was protectionism, and the federal government, which of course is drunk on oil money from Alberta, didn't fight very hard, and we lost the case. So that part of the transition plan has been deemed illegal. There have been lots of these cases. The U.S. has challenged India, China for its subsidies. It's just madness, right? I mean, here we are. We go to climate negotiations. All these same governments, you know, point fingers at each other for not being ambitious enough, and then they run to the WTO and try to knock down each other's windmills, which is exactly what we should not be doing. You have a case here in Germany where Vattenfall has filed an investment protection case against your energy transition policies and is asking for a staggering 4.7 billion euro compensation, which is unprecedented in its ambition and sending, I think, a very dangerous message when we want our governments to feel that they have maximum flexibility to rise to this challenge. Now, one of the debates that is revolving around this book is whether or not it is a critique of neoliberalism or whether it is really about a conflict between capitalism and the climate. On the cover, it says capitalism versus the climate, but what I've been describing just now is a conflict between neoliberalism and the climate. Privatization, deregulation, free trade deals, you know, low taxes. And so it might be tempting to say, okay, we can just return to, you know, a social democratic Keynesian model and all will be well. Here's the problem with that, and the reason why I do think it is a conflict between capitalism and the climate. If we had started cutting our emissions when our government started to meet in the late 1980s, we could have had a gradual transition away from fossil fuels. And it would not have offended the sensibilities of moderate journalists who don't like radical change. We could have, you know, chipped away at it, 2-3% a year, right? But the problem with waiting 2.5 decades and making the problem immeasurably worse, or actually quite measurably worse, is that there is what Michael Mann, a very famous climate scientist at Penn State University, the man responsible for the famous hockey stick graph, which is in Al Gore's movie and causes climate deniers' heads to explode. Michael Mann uses the phrase, the procrastination penalty, to describe what happens when you wait for this long doing nothing. You have to do more to prevent catastrophic warming, because this is the thing about carbon, it sticks around, right? So you emit, and it just stays there, and the problem gets worse and worse, and you blow your global carbon budget. So in the book, I rely on numbers out of the Tyndall Center on Climate Change Research in Manchester, and the work of Kevin Anderson and Alice Bose-Larkin, who are very respected emission reduction experts, climate scientists. They're using the same numbers everyone is using about how much we need to be cutting our emissions by a year to stay within a 2-degree carbon budget, which is we need to be cutting by 6% a year, which is a lot. But it gets worse because Kevin Anderson and Alice Bose-Larkin insist on this inconvenient fact of holding governments to their word that they believe in the principle of historical responsibility, which is enshrined in the UN Climate Convention, which means that countries like yours and mine that have a 200-year head start on in emitting carbon on an industrial scale, need to go first and lead. Doesn't mean China and India are off the hook, but it means we need to cut deeper first. And so that means that what we need to do is cut our emissions by 8 to 10% a year starting immediately. There is no model under which that is compatible with a growth-based economic system. That doesn't mean there can't be any growth in your economy, but it does mean that if you have a capitalist system whose goal is to pursue short-term economic growth, you have a conflict between capitalism and climate. Now, if you're a fan of capitalism, that's a really inconvenient truth. Now, I actually think that the challenge goes even deeper than that, that this is not even just a challenge to capitalism, that it is indeed a challenge to the story that we humans have been telling ourselves since the 1600s, which is that man can dominate this inert machine called nature and bend it to our will. And that idea, which, you know, was born in the British countryside, has spread throughout the world, and it's an extremely dangerous one. And it's what the most interesting part of the research for me was when I came across, through the work of a Swedish coal researcher named Andreas Malm, I came across the texts of the manuals that were used in the 1700s to sell the first commercial steam engine to industrialists in Britain. Basically the ad copy for the Industrial Revolution. These texts are incredibly overt in what industrial use of coal is promising. It is promising liberation from nature. It is promising those who own fleets of ships, you are no longer at the mercy of the waves. You can sail your ship whenever you want. And it's promising to factory owners, you are no longer at the mercy of rushing water, of thinking about, you know, where it makes sense to build your factory and powering your factory with water. You can build it anywhere you want. You are in charge. You are the boss, right? climate change is the belated response, right? Because all the while that we have been burning coal and telling ourselves we have freed ourselves from the natural world, we are now having a one-way communication. We are on top. Now roars the response. You thought you were in charge? You are a guest here. And that is a profound challenge to the core narrative of Western civilization, which is why, frankly, parties of the left have as much trouble dealing with climate change, some of them, as the right. This is a deep challenge. It's a deep challenge to all of us. I realize this is a little overwhelming. I have friends in the environmental movement who taken me aside and say, you know, Naomi, climate change was already big enough. Did you have to make it about capitalism? It's certainly easier to talk about changing light bulbs than changing the economy, and easier to talk about capping carbon than capping corporate power. But here's what I think we need to remember. It's not like we're talking about an economy that is working beautifully, except for the small matter of rising sea levels. We're talking about allowing sea levels to rise in the name of protecting an economic system that is failing the vast majority of people on this planet with or without climate change. A system that has already sacrificed a great many people's job security, their right to good education, decent health care, and now that same system is making it clear that it is willing to sacrifice the stability of the planet's life support systems, and we simply cannot let that happen. I believe that, what I was proposing in Frankfurt, this friendly merger, the reason why I think this could actually happen, not that it is inevitable, you know, it's inevitable, I think, eventually that we transition away from fossil fuels, but it isn't inevitable that we do so on a principle of social justice. That is a choice that we would have to make. But if we make that choice, we have the possibility to create countless good unionized jobs in the next economy. Every dollar invested in renewable energy, efficiency, public transit creates 6 to 8 times as many jobs as, that euro would go in oil and gas infrastructure. Those jobs are part of rebuilding a public sphere that is ailing in almost all of our countries. That infrastructure will give us more livable cities, stronger communities, healthier bodies. With these actions, we can also go a long way towards closing the grotesque inequality gap that scars our societies and plays itself out of control criminal justice system and institutionalized racism. We can find the money to do this by making the polluters pay, whether it's the fossil fuel companies or bloated defense companies or financial speculators. To do any of this, certainly in North America, we have our work cut out for us, reducing the power of corporate money in politics. So this is a big ask, obviously, but here's the good news. All of these movements are growing at absolutely stunning rates. I mean, when I finished the book, I sort of tallied up, you know, the victories that had happened just while I was writing the book. And it was quite staggering, the number of countries that had banned fracking, for instance, and states and provinces. But even since the book came out, I mean, the book came out in English in September, and since that happened, I was just thinking, you know, before coming here tonight, that just the number of things that have happened that I would count as real progress, of genuine speed. 400,000 people marched on the streets of New York City this past September demanding action on climate and demanding specifically climate justice. That's 4 times bigger than the previous largest climate march before it, which was in Copenhagen in 2009. And this is in the United States. Scotland and Wales have both banned fracking in the past month. New York State banned fracking, which was a huge victory for the anti-fracking movement. The fossil fuel divestment movement, this movement that didn't exist just 3 years ago, has spread to hundreds of cities, including Berlin, and university campuses, and huge universities like Stanford, for instance, with a massive endowment, has announced that it's going to divest its holdings from coal. the Rockefeller family, the first family of oil, this is the family that made its money in Standard Oil, has announced that it is divesting from fossil fuels and moving its money to renewable energy, which is really significant. And I was on a talk show actually with one of the heirs of the Rockefeller fortune, and the interviewer said, "Well, isn't this hypocritical since you made your money in oil and now here you are not?" And she's like, "No, I don't think it's hypocritical. I think we have a moral responsibility because we made our money in oil to support solutions to the problem that that created." And to which I would add, this can't just be left to the individual morality of very rich people. If it is wrong for universities and cities and foundations to invest in fossil fuels, then we have a right to those profits to pay for the transition away from fossil fuels. It can't just be voluntary. The Pope is talking about climate change a lot, and in a way that I think is actually really important, because he's talking about it in the language of morality. And I think too often we talk about climate change in the language of cost-benefit analysis and forget that this is the core moral question, perhaps, of our time. In China, the Chinese government has just taken down a video called Under the Dome, but not before it was watched by 150 million people. And this is about the devastating impacts of air pollution linked to coal burning, which is really important, I think, for us to acknowledge the courage of so many Chinese activists in this moment in a country with huge penalties for criticizing the government, standing up to one of the people in the film that my partner Avi Lewis is making to go to, based on the book, talks about low quality growth. And we often sort of scapegoat China and say, well, we're doing so much, but look what China is doing. China is having a much more vibrant debate about the true costs of economic growth than anyone else. And what we need to do is make sure that we do enough in our countries that we don't strengthen the hand of the forces that are arguing that it's our turn to go through our Dickensian phase. So in addition to the fact that the climate movement is changing, is winning big victories against tar sands pipelines, fracking, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about the fact that, I'm quite critical of capitalism, as you may have heard, but I am willing to admit when capitalism gives you a gift, and it has given us one, which is because of speculation and oversupply, the price of oil has just dropped in half in 3 months, which is making it too expensive for a little while to do things like drill for oil in the Arctic. Many companies are pulling out of the Alberta tar sands because, in addition to it being incredibly energy intensive to dig up that very dirty form of oil in semi-solid state, it's also very, very expensive. So this is a moment when we can start winning, going from stopping a pipeline here, stopping fracking there, to actually, I think, aiming in Paris to have leave it in the ground be the goal of that summit, and passing moratoriums on Arctic drilling and closing these fossil fuel frontiers for good. So the other side of this, of course, is that the anti-austerity movement is gaining power, and gaining not just power in the streets, but political power, as we're seeing in Greece, which I understand people here are a little worked up about. I think it's incredibly exciting, and also that... and it looks like Podemos may take power in Spain very soon. This is inspiring people across Europe. So if we can just get out of our boxes and talk to each other, we might actually have a winning coalition. Now, I've been accused of being an optimist lately, which I never thought would happen. I used to be accused of, yeah, we know what you're against, but what are you for? So I've said a few things that I'm for, and they're like, you're an optimist. Here's the thing. I'm not really an optimist. I'm just not a nihilist. I don't believe all is lost. I see this tiny possibility that we could actually turn this around. The stakes are so high that I think we have a massive responsibility to do everything in our power to improve the odds. Thank you so much.
Großer, ausdauernder Applaus für eine Frau, die über sich selbst sagt, ich bin keine Optimistin, ich bin nur keine Nihilistin. Was sie positiv formuliert ist, hat die Autorin Naomi Klein damit immer noch nicht verraten. Eine Realistin vielleicht? Wir werden jedenfalls sehen, wie nihilistisch oder realistisch das Ergebnis der Pariser UN-Konferenz in 2 Wochen ausfallen wird. Falls ihr euch vor dem Beginn der Konferenz am Montag noch tiefer ins Thema reinwühlen wollt, bitte schön, morgen Abend senden wir im Hörsaal eine Vorlesung von Professor Raimund Schwarze vom Helmholtz-Zentrum für Umweltforschung. Der Vortrag heißt »Das Ende der internationalen Klimapolitik oder gerade erst der Anfang?« Und Schwarze hat ihn am 9. November 2015 an der Europa-Universität Viadrina in Frankfurt an der Oder gehalten. Ganz frisch also dieser Vortrag. Diese und Naomi Kleins Rede findet ihr dann wie gewohnt auf www.deradiowissen.de zum Nachhören und zum Runterladen. Hier geht's jetzt gleich weiter mit den Nachrichten und anschließend wird der Samstagabend tanzbar im Club der Republik. Katja Weber wünscht euch noch einen schönen Abend. Bis morgen.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.